My name is David L. Noreen. I'm working for WILL-TV of the University of Illinois at Urbana, and this is also for the Veterans History Project. We're in Hoopston, Illinois at the Hoopston Public Library. Today is November 8, 2007. I'll be talking to Edward J. Layden of Hoopston, Illinois, about his experiences on the home front during World War II. Assisting me on lighting, sound, and camera is Henry M. Radcliffe III. And Mr. Layden, perhaps you could talk about your date of birth and your experiences leading up to World War II to start out with.
Well, I was born May the 23rd, 1919. Went to a one-room grade school out in the country, eighth grade, Goldsboro School. Went to John Greer High School in Hoopston. After high school, I went to the University of Notre Dame for 1 year, but they got me mixed up with pre-med students, and I didn't get along so well. So then I went to University of Wisconsin for a farm short course for 2 winters. Then come back from that and kind of started farming with my dad. Then I was drafted into the Army in, I think it was April the 24th, 1941. I had a shoulder that I had hurt several times playing football, and then some other times too. And after I was in the Army a short time, they jumped out of place, and the doctors would put it back and say, hey, you shouldn't be here, you know. And then about the second time, the regiment that I was in, the colonel that was the 110th Infantry Regiment, he said, we don't want you. He sent me to the hospital. I told him up there, they either operate on that guy and make him 100% fit or send him home. They gave me that choice, so I come home.
At this time, the war hadn't started yet, right? This was still
before
the war.
Yeah, I was discharged on the first day of November, and the war started May the 7th. And I went back to the draft board right afterwards, and they said they'd had notice from
December 7th.
December the 7th. Yeah. This colonel had sent them a letter that not to send me back to the Army. That's what the man, Charlie Dyer, who ran the draft board, he told me that one time. I suppose he did. I don't know. So I was classified 4F from then on.
And so then you came back to Hoopston.
Right.
And worked on your family's farm?
Oh, yeah. That's where I intended to spend my life anyway, you know. My grandfather come around Hoopston in 1877, and then we lived out in that same community. In fact, I have a son who lives on the same farm now today out there.
And, and so there was, after the war started, at some point there was a prisoner of war camp established here in Hoopston,
well,
correct?
It really wasn't an established camp here. They were stationed someplace else, but they were moved here in 1944. Hoopston used to have 3,000 acres of asparagus to cut too, and that was a big project. In fact, my wife said she went to high school in Rossville. They used to let the high school kids out of school if they go cut asparagus in the afternoon.
And this was partly because there were big canning factories at that time.
Yes, there was. There was two in Hoopston, one in Rossville, one in Milford, one in Fowler, one in Paxton, one in Gibson City. And I think maybe these prisoners of war went to several of those camps, but they all lived here in Hoopston during the canning season.
And where was the prisoner of war camp? How was that set up?
Well, it had been it was on the what we call the farm headquarters. And back in the earlier days, you know, they'd have 500 mules doing the farm work. And so they had big barns, and some of them are still standing, and they just clean them out and rearrange things because the people would come in the middle of April, they wouldn't need much heat, and then they'd leave. By that time they were canning some tomatoes too, so they'd leave a few maybe to pick tomatoes, but they'd all be gone before the 15th of October. It would just be summertime help, really. So they wouldn't need much help. And I don't know how many prisoners were around here. There were lots of them, I'm sure. And they even worked in the factories, too, some of them, because they'd march them up the street.
So are you saying that the prisoners were only here for part of the year, or it was the workers that before the war that were just
here? It'd just be the prisoners, but here during, from about the middle of April until the middle of October. And I assume maybe that they would transfer these people back and forth to their main camp, maybe ship some of them other places. I really don't remember that much about them.
And so as it pertains to your family, your family would have a truck and they would make arrangements to go and pick up a certain number of prisoners
right. Each
day to help out.
Yeah, you knew that, the day before what you were going to get. And the rule was that you get 20 prisoners and one guard. So we had what we called a farm truck, with just a grain truck with about an 8 by 12 bed on it. They'd crawl in, They soon figured out where they were going by who the driver was. One of the things I remember about them real distinct is when you pull out on Route 9 and you turn the wrong direction, they say, no, go to Chicago, go to Chicago. Mm-hmm. They learned how to say that. Mm-hmm.
So they would joke around with
oh,
you
gosh,
quite a bit.
Oh, gosh, yeah, they were, yeah.
And so you would pick these prisoners up very early in the morning to work a full day's work, and then.
Well, they wouldn't. No, you didn't work. You didn't work a full day. You'd always be through filling the wagons up by noon, because the canning factory had to have corn to start, and then they had enough wagons that they could fill them up. Sweet corn, you had to almost pick it when it was a little bit wet after the corn would get dry, then it was hard to pick that ear off the stalk. It got hard, difficult. So you usually wanted to be through, you like to be through by 10 o'clock, but most of the time you'd be through by 12. And that's when all the women, they'd fix lunch and stuff for them,
And what would the lunch be?
I thought that would vary from home to home, but they always had cookies and sandwiches, and I think we used to milk a couple of cows, so my mother would make chocolate milk. That's because we drank chocolate milk at home. They like that.
Mm-hmm.
The first year we had prisoners, I think 14 days, and I remember them distinctly because they were in better physical condition than the average American would have been. Found out later that they were part of Rommel's army that had been captured in Africa. And these boys were all about 5'9" or 5'10", up to about 6'2" or 6'3", and very nearly the same age, all in good, perfect physical condition, and knew how to work. The thing I always remember about them, when the average American would jerk corn, you jerk with both hands, and some people would jerk two ears off and throw. Most people would jerk four ears off, because you get them between your fingers if you're strong enough. Once in a while, you'd find some that could get three in each hand, six. And sometime when you had six, if you throw, maybe one of them wouldn't get in the wagon. Well, the average American would forget about that one. These Germans, if one didn't hit the wagon, they wouldn't pick it up. They didn't leave anything in the field. I remember that very distinctly. Yeah.
Okay, and so did the prisoners have a second shift then, that after they were done in the fields, they would go to the canning factory, or they would just return to the camp?
Now, the ones that worked in the factory, I don't know how they, because see, sometimes that factory would work all night. Not usually would work, always would work two shifts. They usually start about, I think they used to always work 15 minutes before the hour. They started, at 6:45, then they'd go off 11:45, and then come back at 12:45, then start another shift. Maybe they start that about 4 o'clock, and then they'd run to 8, 9, 10, 11 o'clock. Whatever was harvested in the day had to be canned that night, or they took it to the cattle pen and dumped the corn, because it wouldn't fit the can the next day.
Okay. So you did this over a period of time. There would be different areas of the field that you would successfully move through each
morning. We would kind of plant the corn scientifically because we knew it take about so many days for the corn to mature. So we would plant sweet corn maybe a couple of days. And we partnered up with a cousin of ours whose father had died, and he farmed out in the community too. And in fact, he was one of the factory workers during the fact. They had to have a lot of help to make sure that the corn was on the way. But nothing got them more excited around the canning factory to have a bunch of people come to work and then 2 hours later run out of corn. You know, that was rather an exciting time. If there wasn't any corn on the way, they'd be there in 15, 20 minutes while they'd ignore it. But then if it's going to be too long, they'd send them home and then bring them back an hour later. What they would do, but we had prisoners the first year. We had 20 prisoners, and we had 5 tractors between us, and we could pull 2 wagons with a tractor, and then there'd be four boys on a wagon. And of course, when you get that 4th row out, that's quite a ways from the wagon, but they would do their shift themselves, you know. One to take the first row and second, and then they'd shift back. Sometimes they'd go, it all depends on how long the rows are. Corn rows are a lot different lengths than people in town realize. There's quarter mile rows, and there's half mile rows, and there's 3/4 mile rows, and there's some that would be only 1/8 of a mile. See. But most of them were 80 rod or 160 rod, quarter or half mile or quarter mile.
Now, at this time, labor was pretty scarce, so having the prisoners was really quite a blessing then.
1943, we didn't have any help, you know, and we liked to never got it harvested. In fact, there was some of it that didn't get harvested. It was just, you know, it was just too much labor. And it's hard to tell until you get into the crop how good the crop is. You know, it would vary from yield to yield, year to year, back in those days, if we had 3-ton corn, that was pretty good. 2-ton was the average, but if you had some that only made 1.5 tons, you know, you didn't have to take as many wagons to the field to get that. See. So it varied every year. And
so now when they would pick the corn, they wouldn't bother to husk it, right? That would be done at the factory.
Yeah, that.
So they're just pulling the
what they call jerk. Right. You jerk it off the stalk. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That's what we all call it. Jerks. You jerk sweet corn. You husk field corn.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And so these prisoners were fairly good workers then. They really welcomed the opportunity get out of the camp and work in the field. Yeah. So.
And they loved to get out in the country. And didn't want to go back after they got out there. Oh, it's too hot back then. Mm-hmm. They'd like to lay out in your yard all afternoon if you let them, you know. It's too hot back in town, you know. But eventually they'd get in the truck and go back.
Now, you mentioned in your materials that at one time there was a young child about 2 years old that...
Well, that would be actually my first cousin's son, and we were probably at their farm. Because here, this little Rick Layden, some of the people around town would know who he is. He still lives here in town. And he was a cute little 2-year-old, doing the kind of a pesty one. And he was flirting with them, you know, and they were flirting with him, too. And one of them kind of caught him and picked him up and gave him a pat on the rump and turned him back down. You could see that he had a tear in his eye or something, you know. And then he got to hold up his fingers. And then I guess somebody figured out what he wants to know how old. Well, he was 2 years old. And then he kind of figured out what month was this. We figured that out. What month is he? Well, they were both about the same age. He was about 2 years old that month or maybe the next month. And then they figured out that he had a boy back in Germany that he had never seen that was born about the same time. See.
So it was one of the prisoners that could speak a little English that was able to explain this to you?
Or? After you've been around a little while, you didn't have to speak much English. You learned the notion things and like that. See, I don't, that first bunch, they didn't speak much English at all. The ones that came in 45, they'd been prisoners longer, some of them, and some of them had spoken some English. I mean, the ones in 44, they were all about the same age, and well, at least the ones that we had, I don't know. There was a lot of prisoners out there, so when you take 20 out of them, you know, that's just a small fraction of what was out here. But in 45, they kind of learned the system a little better, and they found out that the farmer we were, they kind of liked to be out there. And we didn't figure this out until afterwards, that we had a white birch tree in our yard. Well, you know, Germany's full of white birch trees, and there's very few, you don't see very many of them around Hoopston, because we're too far south. You know, Germany's a lot farther north than we are. So they just kind of like that, you see. And then I'm the oldest.
Brought back memories of being in Germany to see the birch
tree. I'm the oldest of eight children, see, and most of these kids, they'd have been around families too. You know, so here, I think my youngest sister was probably in 45. She would have been 9 years, 44, 8 years old in 44, 9 and 45. My oldest sister just graduated from Illinois, you know, and she was still around, you know. And they kind of enjoyed that, I mean, being up around the family. And like I say, the second year we got so we could talk to them more because they understood a little bit. And it'd always be somebody that could figure out what you were trying to talk back and forth.
I was kind of wondering how you figured out that that he had a son about the same age.
Well,
that he'd never seen, the soldier had never seen his.
He was trying to hold up his hand, and somebody, what's the holes that we held up to? He figured that out. See. Uh-huh. And then when he was trying to figure out, so then we figured out, I think we figured out that 8 was when Rick was born, you know. And that's when he figured out that he had a son. And then he could talk to, he was talking German to somebody else that was kind of, that knew a little bit of English.
Uh-huh.
It was rather difficult to do, but eventually, you know, you go back and forth a few times, then you kind of figure out what they're trying to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
But I always remember that incident, you know, because
it's a very touching incident.
And also, my cousin Bob Layden, who was the father of this 2-year-old, was a field man for the factory, and he's the one that drove around and to make sure that proper help was here and the proper help was here, and the wagons were getting loaded, and they'd be in town, but they were like the 9 o'clock or 10 o'clock. They wanted to know all this stuff in town, and back then they had to do it just run back and forth in a car. See, and they'd figured out that this Bob Layden, who was the field man, was related to us. You know, they figured that out themselves.
Uh-huh.
because his wife would be helping, and my mother would be there, and then they'd be at our house, and there'd my mother and Bob's wife would be there. And, you know, they figured things out pretty well, just by being around. See.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned that there's only one guard for the whole group.
One guard for 20 prisoners.
And at times, would there be, you know, different groups of prisoners that the one guard had to, you know, try to keep track of all these people spread out all over the place?
You very seldom saw the guard. He'd be off someplace, like I say, they'd say he was over under a tree asleep. You ask him where the guard, oh, he's over under the tree asleep. You know, which that's probably where he was. But these people, they weren't about to leave. They didn't, well, a couple of times maybe they've tried. I think they said 3 of them escaped one time. I don't remember that, really, but... And then I know the guards sneaked 2 or 3 of them out one night and took them to Watsika to a dance. Well, everybody got in trouble over that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
The guards and the prisoners, too, you know, because somehow they got caught. I don't know how that was. There was a place in Watsika that had a dance every Saturday night, see. I assume some of these guards and the prisoners got, you know, kind of pretty well acquainted, you know.
Did the prisoners always seem to be aware of where the guard was? You know,
oh, like yeah. They always knew where he was, or most of them did anyway.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think they'd have gotten a car and gone with you. if you wanted to take them someplace, I don't think they'd have gone, really. Mm-hmm. Most of them wouldn't. I wouldn't say all of them wouldn't. One of the things I remember, they always wanted, when they got to the second, this has happened more the second year, when they'd be, when there was people in there that could speak a little English, they always wanted to know, how far to Texas? And that was one of the, how far to Texas? Well, we'd try to explain to them 1,000 miles, and they said, 1,000 miles? You know, being in Europe, 1,000 miles in Europe is over three or four countries.
Right.
And finally, then how big is Texas? Well, Texas is bigger than what it is from here to Texas. And see, they can't quite understand that. So one day I just went in and found a map of the United States and took it out and was showing them. Boy, they all wanted to see that. And then they were astonished that everything was so big and so far away. You know, and I found out after that I wasn't supposed to do that. You know, that was against the rules.
It makes it sound like you're helping them escape almost.
So I kind of got a chewing out for that. But right. No, they didn't say too much, but they said, don't be doing that. You know, that's against the rules. But the second year, I had these same four boys for 19 of the 20 days. And three of them were real young kids. You know, they couldn't have been 16, 17 years old. I suppose they've been drafted late. And they had raised on farms in Germany. But in Germany, they were all 20-acre farms, and they'd milk 5 cows or 6 cows. You know, they didn't understand big fields like we had here and big equipment. I took them out to a machine shop and was showing them a corn planter and a cultivator, and they just, you know, they just shake their head, you know. They couldn't believe that we, see, and even that equipment is today is so obsolete, we wouldn't even bother to take it home for them. But they were really inquisitive about the things that went on.
So you mentioned that a lot of times it's probably different groups of prisoners that you get, but then sometimes there'll be the same group of prisoners that work on the farm day after day. And yeah. You kind of get to know them more.
The second year, the group that came out the first day, and then there was another group the second day, but the third day it was the group that came out the first day. And from then on, we had them 20 days that year. From then on, it was that same group of 20 boys. They figured that out, that they liked to be out there. And also my cousin's farm, too, went up there. But they liked that white birch tree. Because that's where they wanted to go sit and rest under the white birch tree.
Now, did they have to wear special prisoner of war uniforms, or?
Yeah, they wore a special uniform, but I can't remember what.
I was just wondering if they did.
PW something. I think it had a number on it. PW number. Yeah.
If they did try to escape, they would probably be recognized very.
Yeah.
Easily, unless they would have to
steal some clothes someplace real quick, or they'd be recognized. Yeah.
Right.
But then back then, everybody was washing clothes, hanging them outside in the summertime. So, you know, if they were around town, they could. But I don't know how they could have got out of Hoopston very easy, because everybody knew who they were. You see, the camp, if they were out by themselves, they would know something was wrong. But I don't think most of them would want to escape. You know, they knew they were here, and what life wasn't too bad. When they worked, they got 80 cents a day to spend for cigarettes and pop and whatever else they could get, see. And when they didn't work, they didn't get anything. The government charged the farmers the prevailing wage for jerking the corn, see. But they took off. Took care of all that. You didn't handle any money. The government and the candy factory would settle up with them.
Yeah. So on your farm, besides helping with the corn harvest, did they do other work as well? Or
no, that's the only thing they've done for us is sweet corn. Mm-hmm. But I know a lot of them cut asparagus, and there was. I don't know what they've done between the asparagus pack and sweet corn. There's always a gap of about 6 weeks between the end of the asparagus pack and the sweet corn pack. I don't know what they, I suppose they just lay around camp, or maybe they take them back to the other, where they come from in the first place. Some of them used to stay at Fort Grant, Camp Grant, northern Illinois. And then there was another camp around Peoria, I think. But they really they saved the crop in 44 and 45. Guys, we went through that harvest easy, you know, from a farmer's standpoint. All we had to do is drive the tractor.
Now, was there any competition among different farmers to get the German prisoners work, or did they just bring down the number of prisoners that were needed for all the farmers that had a harvest that they wanted?
I'm sure there was a lot of negotiating done between the people at the canning factory that were arranging for this and the government somewhere. There had to be some mutual agreements as to how many you would need. And like I say, I think they went to five or six different places, canning factories, to help can corn. So they pretty much knew what they needed.
Mm-hmm.
People are in that business could figure that out pretty quick, what they would need. Another thing I remember about them, though, that they always wanted to smoke. Stop at about every end, or maybe in the shorter fields they'd go around, but they'd have to stop and smoke. I think every one of them smoked. And see, back in those days, well, I guess maybe I smoked a pipe once in a while back then, but my brother Tom, who was home too, he always brags about how he quit smoking when he was 14. See. But these boys always wanted a cigarette.
Now, you mentioned that you also had a second story, too, when we were talking on the phone.
My father had an older brother who had gone to the University of Illinois and got a law degree and went to Oklahoma to live in 1910. And he used to come back every summer because his wife's family was here, and his parents, my grandfather, was out, so he'd come up here. But he always take the month of August off from his law practice. And he used to do a lot of traveling. But then during the war, when gas was hard to get, he could get enough gas to get to Hoopston because he knew my dad would have some extra. He had the coupons, that you could hand out.
Gasoline rationing coupons.
Yeah.
You
didn't want to hand out too many because they didn't give you really too much extra. But then they always managed to get farmers enough to do what you had to do.
Mm-hmm.
And you'd have a few surplus. The second year he came, he left, and then he come back. They were still here for a couple of days. And he thought, boy, they're interesting to be around. So the second year, he got here before the pack started. And he was out there every day. He stayed with his sister, my aunt, out there every day. And he got to talking to those boys every day. And he found
because
some
he knew some German then, so he could.
And he spoke a little bit of German. He'd gone to Greer College here in Hoopston back in, he was born in 85, so that was probably about 1905 when he was going to Greer 4 and 5, I suppose. I don't know exactly when. But anyway, he could speak enough with them, and he found some of those boys that were pretty well informed. He'd like argue with them. There'd be three or four of them in the corner and talk. Well, I finally discovered one boy that was from Frankfurt, Germany. Well, my cousin Bill had been with Patton's Army, and he'd gone across Germany, just like he says, faster than you could run, and was stationed near Frankfurt. When Uncle John found this guy, found him there, he wrote to his son and told him to go into Frankfurt and look up this boy's parents and tell him that he'd seen his son out on his uncle's farm and help him with the harvest of crop. And he wrote back and said, nothing to do with those dirty so-and-sos. This was in August after the war had ended in May. And then a year and a half later, Bill got, I don't know how he got to stay in Germany, but he got charge of a PA, PX over there. So he got to stay in Germany, and he met this German girl, and he married her and brought her home about a year and a half later. And that's, he wouldn't have nothing to do with it.
He wouldn't have anything to do with the Germans until he married one, huh?
And then she had a younger brother who went to med school and come back, lived in Chicago and practiced medicine in Chicago all his life then, afterward. And she fit in, of course, my family, mostly all Irish, you know, and you don't mix with the Germans too much when you were Irish back way back then, you know. But she mixed right in, you know. I think she had four kids, and a lot of them still in Oklahoma, the same place, practicing law. My uncle had sons and grandsons and probably great-grandsons, probably in that same law firm. We've kind of lost track of all them because they've all passed on, you see.
So what other kinds of conversations did the lawyer have with the prisoners?
They were talking about things that would be happening. Now, he was better read and listened to the radio more than I did. I mean, I don't know what they were. They were discussing things that...
Political issues of the day things about the war philosophies of the two countries.
They seemed to be having a good time doing it. I mean, you'd see them throw their hands up.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing I remember one time, I don't know how this got started, but somebody started asking them, what were you in the army? Well, one of them was this and one of them was this. And you know, they tell you what part of the army they were in. And one of them said, secret weapons. And all the PW, secret weapons.
Was he not supposed to say that? Was that supposed
to be? They figured out there is no secret weapons anymore. But this boy, and then they were jabbering to him in German, you know. And then they say, he hadn't woke up yet. I remember that. They gave him the raspberries. Because he was a secret weapon, so he wasn't going to tell them what he did.
So how long did the lawyer visit for then?
He was there. These boys were there 20 days the second year, and he was here when they got here, and he was still here when they left.
Oh, okay.
So he was out there every day visiting with them. And I don't know how long he'd been here when he discovered this one boy from Frankfurt. I don't know, somewhere in through there. When he went back, when he sent the letter back, and we got word back that I think probably that the PWs even left probably before we got word back that Bill had answered. Because back then, mail doesn't travel like it does today. But we found out after, you know, that he wasn't going to go see this boy's parents.
Mm-hmm. So did the prisoners ever get mail while they were in their prisoner of war camp? Did it seem like they were able to keep in touch at all with things back in Germany?
I don't know whether they did or not. I assume maybe they did. Now, there's one thing that I do remember talking with two or three of these boys that could speak a little bit of English. They were surprised when they landed at New York, and this was a group from 45, I think. Because, like I say, the group from 44, they didn't speak a whole lot of English, and they were all these German, they had been in Rommel's army. And we communicated a little bit, but not near as much like we did the one in 45. But these people that come in New York in 45, they were surprised that there was any buildings still standing in New York. They'd been led to believe that New York was pretty much leveled off.
So this was propaganda that that Germany had been bombing New York City for quite some time.
It had
been reduced to rubble.
And a lot of these boys had already come to that. Even the ones in 44 had realized that the war was over as far as they were concerned. They just quit because they knew they weren't going to win anything. And actually, these boys that were captured in Africa, I don't know where they were before they come to America. I guess we never talked about. You know, we didn't talk about things like that that I remember of.
Mm-hmm.
All I remember, they were men. I mean, they could take care of themselves.
And so, the prisoners always had the impression of being very well fed and very well taken care of.
Yeah. That, and I think they got fed pretty well at the camp here. I don't know. They'd always bring a lunch with them, mm-hmm. and I don't remember what they were eating, really. I assume that they had breakfast before they left. I don't know. I don't remember talking to them about that.
And so there were never any problems at all with them as workers, because they were so happy to be out of the camp and earning the extra.
Oh, yeah, money. They liked that at 80 cents a day. You know, that gave them pretty good spending money, you know. Mm-hmm. And they didn't like to go back to town because it was going to be hot. Those old barns that the mules used to stay in with was all sheet metal. You know, it'd be hot inside there. Mm-hmm. And there wasn't a whole lot of shade around under. I don't know. They'd rather stay out in the country or those trees. Mm-hmm. And then I think maybe I told you about the family that lived right south of what we call the prison camp. That was the old Joan of Arc farm headquarters. Was a family by the name of Schuler that had a big greenhouse, and both of these people were German people, and they could speak German. I don't know whether they were born in Germany, but I know they could speak German, and these boys would line up along the fence and they'd visit a lot every day. Now, mm-hmm. now Mr. Schuler wouldn't, because he was always working in the greenhouse. He's one of those people that you work daylight or dark, you know. But Mrs. Schuler, she'd be out there visited with them. They knew who she was. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And at the program we had here before, there was a man here who was about 10 years old, and I don't remember all the circumstances, but he lived along the streets or someplace where they used to march back and forth, and they would sneak him in, and he'd play cards with them down at the camp. He remembered him real well. Because I think his dad worked at the factory, and he went to school probably at Lincoln School. Well, the Lincoln School's torn down now, but that's where they would go by every day, going from the camp to the factory, the ones that worked in the factory. And this boy, he'd follow along with them. So he learned the German card games.
I think he was profiled in a News Gazette article a while back, right?
Was it?
Because I think I've read that story.
I think he was about 10 years old at that time. Yeah, it could have been, yeah. Well, I get the News Gazette. I don't remember reading that, though, maybe. Because some days I miss part of it again. Well, they worked out real well, you know, except the man by the name of Camel, who had been a German prisoner, and he didn't get treated so well. He's written a book about his diary, you know, and said there were days that he had nothing, no food or water, all day, you know. And this is when the Americans were coming and the Russians were coming and the Germans were trying to keep them out of the way, you know, trying to keep them away, you know. And they didn't know where they were marching, but they just march, get going, you know. Mm-hmm. And then when this Camel, when he found out that his mother had been feeding him too, he almost cried here at that program. You fed those people.
Yeah.
They were starving me to death. I'm sure if you could interview some of those boys, they'd say, "Oh, they were treated pretty well."
Mm-hmm.
But we got our crop harvested too. We were thankful to get our crop harvested.
So it worked out very well for all parties: the canning factories,
right.
The prisoners, the farmers.
In fact, even the asparagus was probably harder to harvest because it was all hand labor. I don't know if you've probably never seen an asparagus field, but
no, I don't think so.
See, it only gets up about so high when you have to bend over and you break it off or you cut it with a knife. I mean, they've tried to harvest about every way you can, except it's hard to harvest with a machine. You can harvest it with a machine, but you can't eliminate the sand, and when you harvest it and get the sand in the can, then the people don't like the asparagus.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why it moved out of this part of the country different parts of the country where they can harvest with machines and without getting the sand in. Because I know there was more than 3,000 acres of asparagus within 25 miles from where we're sitting right now at one time, big circle around.
Well, this has been a very interesting story. Do you have any concluding comments or anything you'd like to add at the very end here?
Well, I guess the only thing that I think about is, boy, I wish I'd have just kept track of two of those boys, because my wife has a younger brother, or no, I guess he's older than she is, that was stationed in Nuremberg after the end of the war. He and his two of them had farm deferments until the war ended, and then those boys, their farm deferment expired, and they had to go service for a couple of years. Well, other people were being discharged, and they were stationed at Nuremberg, and her brother married a girl from Nuremberg. And they lived in Rawlsville, now living back in Nuremberg now. In fact, he was here during the month of September. They come over back every year for the month of September, you know. But I wish I could have looked up two of those boys over there, or one of them anyway, guy. Mm-hmm. Now, I understand there's been two or three of them that have come back, and they always look for a man named Baz Sims. Baz Sims was the field man for the canning operations. And he's the one that assigned, you know, 20 in this one, 20 here, and 20, how they went out. But he died years ago, but they were always looked for him. But they remembered him.
Has anyone ever contacted the library here or Chamber of Commerce? Any Germans asking about this town, you know, anything like that?
You know, I don't know. I'm sure there's been probably more than that come back. One lady that lives in Hoopston now that's kind of looked up the history of the PWs, and I think she works for the News Gazette now, feature stories or something. I'd have to ask my wife what her name is. I don't know. But, you know, I always thought it was funny that they didn't look up my brother Tom and I. We were, with them every day. Well, not almost every day, you know, but nobody seemed to pay attention to it. In fact, there's another fellow here in town that's a year older than I, who worked for the canning factory as a field man, too, that could probably tell you all kinds of more interesting stories than I could tell you. But he's in the nursing home out here, and I don't think his mind could help him much. You know, he's a year older than I am, but he'd worked there he was a farmer and then worked part-time for them, you see. And he could tell you all kinds of interesting stories. Mm-hmm. And my cousin could have too, but then he died 20 years ago too, you see.
Well, we're very grateful for your participation.
Well, I'm happy to do it.
Hopefully there will be some follow-up on this. And
okay.
Have other people get a chance to hear your story as well.
Okay.
Thank you.
I can move my feet now?
You can tap away.
I don't think I tapped any, did I?
No, I don't think you did.